If you want to hear about the opportunities that we are presenting to our investors, go to BrickinInvestmentGroup.com and join the Brickin Investor Club. We scour for the best opportunities and present those only to folks inside the club, and that is the only way you'll hear about our deals and what we're working on. We'd love for you to be a part. Again, go to BrickinInvestmentGroup.com and join the Brickin Investor Club.
And equity is a word that's incredibly overused in our social construct today, but it's right. People are getting further away from opportunity. And I think as, especially as entrepreneurs, the more we continue to give more people accessibility to the opportunities that we get, the better off we're going to be as a society.
Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big.
Matt Ryan is the principal of Revive. With over 10 years of experience in real estate and construction, Ryan founded Revive to re-engineer residential and commercial real estate in underserved communities. The company's mission follows his passion for urban policy, building technology, and social impact ventures. Matt, welcome to the show.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
The pleasure is all mine. The same questions I ask everybody who comes on the show is, where did you start? Where are you now? And how did you get there?
Yeah, absolutely. For me, mine goes even back further to 2010 when I bootstrapped a construction company focused on energy efficiency and green building. It was a great time to start a construction company, come like smack dab in the middle of a recession. Of course, I mean that sarcastically, but at the time I saw this as a growing element to the clean tech industry and something that really interested me. And I kind of followed my passion that I found later in life, obviously, which is for buildings as well as, you know, urban policy and how it kind of fits in the big picture. And it was around that time, about halfway through, I bought my first investment property. I had about $60,000 that I was trying to invest in the stock market. And it was basically generating, you know, 2 to 3% through a local stockbroker. And, you know, I said, hey, I can do better than this. So I bought a foreclosed duplex in an up-and-coming neighborhood and renovated it, leased it before the power even got turned on. People thought I was crazy. I showed it to this couple. And I talked to him about all the things that I had done, you know, energy efficiency things I had done, as well as just, you know, the work that we had put into it. And they were so impressed that they leased it from me that day. And I just, at that time, the light kind of went off. I said, hey, you know, here I am now. I'm reaping like a 12 to 13% return, cash on cash. Like, this is a good deal. I should look into this more. And it was in one of those up and coming neighborhoods, which I found over the years, it just kind of had a knack for finding. You know, and so that really, in addition to an connection that I had with a local community member, Miss Pam, which there's a story about her in my website, that kind of kicked off the idea behind Revive and, you know, how we're going to revitalize these communities, as well as being sensitive to the community members that are there. And, you know, some of the problems that we have with value add investing and some of the problems it's creating and within our social structure. And so that was kind of the basics of how I got started.
That's interesting. So what's your company look like today then?
Right now, we're focused on BNC, multifamily value add, trying to position that. We have our own in-house value add strategy that we adhere to that tries to focus on retention of existing tenants instead of displacement. Our hope behind that is to build a scalable model that we can then turn around and bring some innovative approaches to affordable housing, workforce housing. These are terminologies that are used. They're a little bit trite, you know, and I don't think everyone really understands, but let's just talk about what it is. It's existing housing, right? That's affordable, that now this new class of high to middle income earners are moving into these otherwise poor to middle class neighborhoods and seeking affordability and subsequently driving those existing community members out. Right. And it's really a construct of us just simply not building enough homes in a lot of these major metros. And so our idea is to really provide returns for our investors, renovating those while being conscious of these existing community members and the problems it creates. Secondarily, we focused on co-living, which is there's a big thesis behind that, which is how we can basically cater to this 22 to 35 demographic. AKA, you know, a large portion of these people are being blamed as being the gentrifiers, who again, these are people out of college with a bachelor's degree, trying to live to close to urban cores, you know, trying to have a good quality of life. And they're saddled with college debt. You know, they're struggling to find affordable places to live before they enter that home buyer market. And so we once again, saw that as a great opportunity to build a scalable model within these major metros that we could focus on delivering co-living products, which we felt was really kind of a sector that is continually really getting a stronghold in the marketplace and really becoming its own individual sub-market. And so that's been our focus for the last 3 to 4 years.
Let's rewind a little bit and touch back on the retention versus displacement topic.
Yep.
How do you do that and retain, or how do you retain the tenants that are there maybe and yet, you know, still drive a value add
It's a great question. So we created a formula that basically takes into consideration 3 to 4 elements. All right. The first one is when you're doing executing a value add strategy, you have your renovation cost, right? But you also have these hidden costs. You have your vacancy cost, which I don't think people will do a great job of really nailing down. Most projects typically take longer than you're expecting. Sometimes you can double your vacancy cost, which can really kill you In addition to that, there's lease-up costs. Again, another hidden cost I don't think people factor. Sometimes property managers are going to take half a month's rent or a full month's rent, or a third of that. So when you factor all those three things in addition to kind of the fourth element for us, which is what we try to go in, is we try to negotiate a lease upfront that extends, like say, maybe a 2-year period and does a gradual rent increase. In addition to that, we offer tenants code-related improvements. A lot of these apartments, they're not in great condition. So that's kind of where you get in this dance a little bit. It's like, we don't want to be blamed as coming in someone who's just jacking up rents to jack up rents. But the fact remains that these properties are old, they're tired. And a lot of these people have maybe exchanged some level of quality of life in their apartment for affordability. And so that's a difficult, it's difficult territory, right? So what we try to negotiate is a long-term lease with them and a gradual step up so they can have predictability. And in doing so, when we're forecasting and running our models, we're essentially in the black. So if you factor in the saved renovation costs, vacancy, in addition to lease up, we make profit if we continue to, if we sign a 2-year lease with that individual. And so it's a win-win for us. And guess what? It's not perfect. Like, not everyone takes that deal. Sometimes the rent increase jump is just too much for them to digest. Sometimes we found that the tenants that are a little bit more difficult, they immediately have that mentality of like, you're just coming in here and trying to greedy landlord. We're like, listen, you got brown water coming out of your pipes. Like, this is going to take money to fix. You got a leaky roof. And, we've lost tenants, but we've also retained tenants. And that's the idea, is that this isn't a perfect thing, right? And really where it doesn't become perfect is we're obviously losing some revenue, right? There's some net operating that we're missing there. And the idea behind this is that if we had debt providers who could come in eventually and give us, say, 50 to 75 to 100 basis points, or maybe a higher loan to cost, which, by the way, there's an accelerator fund in San Francisco that started. So this isn't a new idea. It's kind of a mimicking of their model, that we could essentially still provide the same IRR to investors, on a value add opportunistic profile, 14 to 20% IRR. Hopefully a lot of that's gone these days because of cap rate compression, but kind of given that opportunistic return profile, but still do some good, have focus on some tenant retention. But that's the gap in society right now. That's the gap in the model right now. There's no debt providers that are specifically targeting that. And by trying to grow and scale this kind of, call it, goodwill value add strategy, in time we'd like to increase the message and get it out there and hopefully find some debt providers who would be willing to come to the table. We have some ideas about people who would be willing to do that. But you really got to, obviously, you got to get enough units, you got to have some scale to a model like that before people pay attention to you.
Right. Yeah. There's not somebody out there on the large institutional lending side that's probably looking for a couple hundred units to do that on. They're going to be looking for you to really have something moving that they can put their name behind. I mean, because that's their buy-in on the deal too, right? Like, oh, hey, look at the program we're helping to support, low-income housing or affordable housing, whatever you want to call it. I mean, so that's image and branding for them as well. So cool.
Yeah.
That's really cool. Let's talk about co-living. I don't even know necessarily. Mm-hmm. You briefly described it, but I'm not even sure I know what that means.
There's a lot of people in the market who don't. The way I describe it to people is it's kind of monetizing this Craigslist model, right? These people who are moving into 3 to 4 to 5 bedrooms, rental units, turning around and then master leasing or subleasing those out to friends, or maybe in some of the major metros. Sometimes it's just strangers. You go to Craigslist, you post a roommate share, you interview people. For people who don't live in major metros, it seems like a very foreign thing. Like, why would I ever live with strangers? Well, when you kind of price the delta on going and renting a studio by yourself versus a 4-bedroom, you get some economies of scale, right? You can bring your price down. I did that when I moved to San Francisco. I rented a 2-bedroom. It cost me $1,000 less per month.
Wow.
But there's headaches that comes with that, right? How are you going to clean it? How are you going to split up the utilities? How are you going to furnish it? So these co-living operators kind of originated in the Bay Area and in Europe even before us. And they said, hey, we're going to simplify this model. It's a little bit broken from a management strategy. We're going to provide kind of a turnkey solution for these people. We're going to do it on these tech platforms where people can, they can expedite the leasing process, have 3D models. Everyone can do it right here, just within your phone. And Common, along with a bunch of other operators, have really come up with these sophisticated leasing models. and they're just absolutely crushing it right now. I mean, absolutely crushing it. And they're moving into institutional grade assets. So now you're even seeing purpose-built co-living, where you have, say, 4 to 5, 6 bedroom models with a common living space, right, and they're all rented on a per bedroom basis. Again, it's catered to a 22 to 35 demographic, bachelor's degree, working professionals, tech entrepreneurs, so on and so forth. Sometimes you'll see a small group of founders or, you know, early employees kind of buddy into a house. You've seen that a lot in the Valley and in San Francisco. And so, yeah, that's basically the model in a nutshell. It's expanding rapidly, man. I mean, we're seeing exponential growth.
Yeah. You know, I've seen that in the multi-generational, again, not even sure if you'd call that co-living or not, but seeing a lot of the multi-generational housing being purpose-built for that, you know, it'd be 5, 6 bedrooms. I interviewed somebody here recently and I wish I could find the episode number right off the top of my head, which I can't because it's a daily show. But yeah, it was somebody that all they're doing is building purpose-built like 5 and 6 bedroom homes. And yep, then they've got grandparents, you know, they've got parents, they've got kids, everybody living in the same house, and even into adulthood, which actually, you know, in a lot of countries around the world, that's not uncommon.
It's not. I think with the growing of accessory dwelling units, we're really, the great generation's retiring, right? And they're going to be moving into what would normally be healthcare facilities, right? But I think we are shifting as a society where we're saying, you know what, we could also use the help, because most parents are 2 working parents. My wife and I both work. Right. Our parents are 3,000 miles away. To have someone literally in our backyards, to some people, depending on your relationship with your parents, may not be an ideal model. But to others, it's great. And even if it's not your parents, you know, you're seeing it more and more. And I do think there's adaptations of co-living for senior housing as well, because a lot of what you're talking about is a lot of these seniors, they want to be in accessible areas. They don't want to have to get into a car. You know, they want walkable, bikeable. So you're getting these in higher density areas, and you're seeing like these little 12 to 20 to maybe 30 bedroom care facilities retrofitted out of Victorians. We've seen in San Francisco. So I think there's, again, adaptation to your point that you can do the co-living model. There's even kind of fractional ownership models where families are all kind of moving in together and helping each other with childcare, because, you know, all these societal burdens we're finding ways to redistribute them, because there's just not good models for us today.
Right. No. And I think there's a lot of merit to that. And if it's what people want, then why not? I mean, why not go for it and see where that goes? So is this co-living stuff that you're building out right now? Are you guys actually developing the co-living?
We started with the model in Oakland and Berkeley, which was converting duplexes, triplexes, and quadplexes. And using, again, an adaptation of a lot of these homes require structural retrofits. Right. So a lot of times you can get an extra floor on the bottom because you're building out a whole new foundation. California passed an accessory dwelling unit, ADU law, which you can add up to 11 to 1200, depending on the jurisdiction, of square feet in the backyard. Mm-hmm. Like within, they have to prove it in 60 days. You don't have to go through zoning rigmarole. This is just, you can do it and you can add up to 2 units. So we kind of created in a model that was an adaptation of a local co-living operator who had some early success in the Oakland Berkeley markets of getting, you know, taking a 2,000, 3,000 square foot house, getting it to 4 to maybe 5,000 square feet, 10 to 12 to 14 bedrooms. In addition to that, we were looking at larger industrial, because there's a lot of retired brick and timber industrial buildings that have kind of reached their industrial use life and are now good fits for conversion to residential. And so when we launched our Opportunity Zone in 2019, we really focused on this model going after these. We felt like it was scalable. We could get product 12 to 24 months. We didn't have to go through, you know, if we were going to purpose-built ground up, mid-rise and high-rise, you're talking 3 to 4 to 6 years. We really felt like this was a great opportunity for us to scale, but we ran into some big, big hurdles. And it kind of, with respect to your podcast, what did we learn? I thought about this before the call. I'd say the best way to summarize this is we kind of created this in a vacuum. My architect, who owns a design draw build firm, so he's integrated architectural and GC. We kind of created it in a vacuum on a pro forma, you know, and we had case studies of local guys who had been successful. We looked at some projects. We said, hey, you know, we need to hit this price per square foot. Everything seemed well put together. But where we really failed is there's a couple market conditions. There's rent control, which makes it increasingly difficult to find vacant buildings. And what we didn't do is we didn't aggregate that product in past sales. And when COVID hit and we had really struggled for 12 to 16 months to find product that we could really fit, going into contracts, trying to negotiate concessions, trying to get a deal over the finish line that hit our financial metrics. Really what we, during COVID, we got smart, kind of sitting on our hands anyways. We started aggregating large swaths of data and going back and looking at how many of these deals actually made sense. So we came up with like a quick rent calculator cap on cost. And we would say, okay, we need to hit up 5.5% cap on costs for a deal to even look make sense. We'd highlight those. We'd have 12 to 20. And then we'd start thumbing through all of them to see how many of them, I mean, you know, going from like 100 to 150 homes down to 20. And what we found was there just wasn't enough deal volume. When you really got down to the nuts and bolts of the product and the deals that were hitting the market, I mean, we had maybe 2 to 3 potentials every 60 days. And these are small cap deals. You know, these are all under 10 million. You can't live off of that. And so when you think about scaling your operations, like, of course, I patted myself on the back. This is a great idea. We're going to, and it's the 10 to 50 bedroom model of co-living is still completely uncharted waters. No one's attacking that. All the larger operators are moving to 50 to 200 institutional grade assets. There's nothing in the middle market for co-living. And I think that's still an incredible market. The problem is our metro just didn't make sense. It didn't have enough deal volume. And so when you're talking about scaling your operations and going after a product in a particular market, my suggestion to any real estate investor is don't just look at your pro forma. Don't just talk to your property managers, your brokers. Really dig back through the historical data. What's traded in the last 18 to 20 months? And are you going to have enough deal volume to sustain? There's no set metrics in the real estate world as to how many deals you have to go after to the one you get. I've heard 100 to 1. Shit, it feels like that for me, but it's getting harder and harder, right? So it's like, you really have to, it's a numbers game. And you really, it's not just about getting a pro forma. It's about what type of product is out there and is actually changing hands. And are you actually going to make good runs at and have good opportunities? Because if you don't have that deal volume, which we found out post-COVID, both BNC multifamily product that we were in the market that we were in the co-living product, we said, man, we got to go out to other markets. That was the thing we tried to avoid prior to this. We really wanted to hone in on our backyard, but the market conditions weren't just conducive to that, at least for our return profile. We want a good mixture of cash flow and equity growth. You know, I call it middle of the fairway. Most of the product that you're seeing now, there's a lot of 1031 investors who are just buying for long-term appreciation, especially once you get under 20 million, and there's just no cash flow. And I'm not going to buy a deal that's going to yield less than 2% cash. To me, that's just setting yourself up for failure.
Oh, for sure. That's interesting. So you guys, so the solution to this was to go outside your market.
Yeah, which we're getting ready to do. Of course, as soon as we started to pull the trigger on going outside of our market, we found a co-living operator that trying to raise some equity for on some of their products that they're growing and scaling quite quickly on, institutional grade developer. I'm not doing anything in the small space that we were in. And then, you know, within that, we did a small adaptation. We're looking at a live work conversion, which is, again, kind of an adaptation to co-living. It's not specifically co-living, but it's basically just a residential build, but using the live work code in Oakland that allows you to designate some commercial space and kind of surpass some of the additional resi requirements, residential conversion requirements. It's a little bit more lax because it's accepting the fact that you're taking an industrial building and converting it to residential. And so we're kicking off our first live work product, hopefully in the next 30 days. We got 30 days left to do diligence. And I think that's another interesting kind of market segment that very similar to co-living. A lot of the co-living models we were looking at, we're going to have a co-working component. You know, it's going to be mixed use office and resi, which makes a lot of sense. So it wasn't too far of a deviation for us. Yeah. So we're going to be pursuing a lot of that in the Oakland Berkeley markets, hopefully in the near future. But as far as that co-living 10 to 50, yeah, man, we're going out to other markets, workforce housing, BNC. We got to find the next up and coming markets because it's just getting harder and harder in the NorCal to really make projects make sense.
Right. And not only projects make sense, but it just sounds like there wasn't the inventory that fit really the buy box you guys were hunting.
I mean, yeah. And we've seen inventory pick up, but it's just for us, again, it's just we're trading sub 4.5 cap deals on C value add properties.
Wow.
To me, that's a kiss of death. Right. That's a kiss of death. If interest rates ever do go up in 3 to 5 years, historical interest rates, we return even 50 to 75 basis points below the historical average. I mean, people are going to get hurt. You know, that's a lot of equity that you may have grown. And maybe rent growth keeps you afloat. But I don't know. I'm for one, I think we've seen the peak of rent growth. I don't know that people can afford much more.
Right. No, that would open a whole new can of worms discussion. I'd love to go down that down that rabbit hole. But man, you know, I don't think we have the time for that one today. But yeah,
definitely not.
No, hey, let's jump here into the final four. This has been absolutely fascinating. I mean, I love it when there's somebody out there thinking very differently about how to, one, make deals make sense, how to do something differently that everybody else isn't doing, And, you know, and the co-living thing is just really fascinating. You know, that's something we don't hear a lot about. I know, like you said, it's a big thing. Oh, one question I did have for you, what are some websites we can go look at that are people that are out there kind of hosting the co-living, you know, platform?
Yeah. Common is, I mean, they're the 800 pound gorilla and they've just established themselves as the 800 pound gorilla because they just took down the number two and number three operators in the space.
Oh, wow.
And so, I mean, they're running a marathon and they're on the, you know, 15th mile and everyone's still on the second and third. And so they're far beyond, and I'd say they're the A-class player. There's a lot of other small boutique co-living operators who are trying to get started. So just type them in, check them out, which, you know, by no means are they any less quality as far as what they provide and the services that they can do. Common just said, we're going to be the dominant institutional player in the space. And that's, they've done it.
Right.
Yeah. And the one thing I'd add very quickly, so much about Revive was just based on innovative approaches to affordable housing and community revitalization. What is this problem that we're facing? We're not producing enough housing. People are going to continue to move into these geographic regions that have affordability, and being able to find balance between the incoming people and the people that are there, that's really the thesis. And I do think that the affordable housing system is kind of broken. It's a wealth redistribution model. And like anything, early on in my career, it was about entrepreneurialism, the ability for people to come in and solve problems in the private market. And to me, that's really kind of what we're about. And what I think why we're trying to bleed the line between these, call it kind of a for-profit developer and a nonprofit developer. I do think it's possible. And I think unless we federally and locally start getting serious about building housing again and keeping up with them, we're going to have to continue to innovate in the space all the way down to modular housing. You're seeing all these things starting to ebb and flow, but it's going to take some innovation to get there.
Right. And it sounds like you guys are leading the way on that. So that's really cool.
We're certainly trying.
Yeah, absolutely. And nothing else, doing your part along the way. So that's fantastic. Matt, here, let's jump into the final four. The first question is this: what is one piece of advice you would give to an aspiring investor?
Yeah, I would say this is probably one that's very much overused, but associate with the people that are 10 years ahead of you, 15 years ahead of you. I've always been like just this run into a brick wall, beat my head bloody. I don't always like asking for advice or kind of, and it took me a long time to really understand the true value of associating with people. You know, you don't have to ask someone to be your mentor. You don't have to ask to take someone out to coffee. It could be something as simple as just, I'm going to need 15 minutes of your time. I got a problem I'm doing, or I got a deal I'm looking for, you know, that may benefit you. You know, find ways to provide value for people and get some insight in return. And even if it's hiring a consultant, you know, I hired a fractional COO that works 10 hours a week for me, and he's a 20-year vet. And the amount of value that Brian's added in the last 60 days that he's been working for me and helping me kind of unwrap and unravel some of these issues that I've been having that's been keeping us from scaling and really growing our operations, it's invaluable. And I pay Brian a premium, but you consider the opportunity cost of not having him, it's a great investment.
Right. Yeah, that's an excellent point. Question number two is this: when it comes to investing in yourself, what is one thing you're doing to stay on top of your game?
The best thing I did was I downloaded a Kindle app. I turned off all the social media on my phone and I just buy Kindle books, man. I try to get 30 minutes a day on my Kindle, and most of it's nerdy, boring business books that I feel like I'm gouging my eyes out to get through. But once I reach that point, I'm still like, there's one little piece of nugget of information that I'm picking up along the way. And that's the thing about being an entrepreneur. It's like, it's a brick by brick endeavor. There's some A players and some studs out there who just, like a great athlete, can walk on the field and just dominate.
Right.
But then there's the rest of us. And the rest of us don't get there reading 10 books and calling yourselves an expert. It's an incremental, piece by piece. You got to have experience. You got to get bloodied up. You got to walk away just feeling like you're exasperated, tired, but then having, you know, just continue to grind and finding that additional one little extra piece that's going to sharpen your saw enough that's going to get you over that next hump. Right. And that's what I've found. You know, there's really no quick fixes.
Right. Absolutely true. Question number three is this: when it comes to investing in the world, what is one way you're making the world a better place?
Yeah. I mean, most of our social impact piece is based around that we're trying to return 1% of profits of Revive back into the communities where we invest. So we can create a better trust between where we're investing, between the community members, where we're investing and developing assets and the community. And, you know, that trust has very much been broken within the communities. because of just the structure and context of real estate. And we want to break those models down. One of my biggest passions that I want to do is I want to create a social impact fund where people who live in the communities where we invest can invest in our projects through crowdsourcing, investing as little as $500 to $1,000. That's probably one of the largest goals that I have, in addition to creating a nonprofit associated with Revive, providing consulting to local municipalities and governments to help better expedite this process, community revitalization, and bring intellectual property to it. But I think the biggest one in that is we need to get to a point where, again, the grandma who's lived in the neighborhood that you're investing in can go into one of your projects and invest in a house two doors down from her for $500 and get the same return that you and I are available to. I think once we get to that point, I think no longer can public officials and kind of the overall society begin to treat us as investors and developers as the used car salesman. I think they're going to see that, hey, this is available and accessible to everyone. And equity is a word that's incredibly overused in our social construct today, but it is right. People are getting further away from opportunity. And I think especially as entrepreneurs, the more we continue to give more people accessibility to the opportunities that we get, the better off we're going to be as a society.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Matt, if our listeners want to get in touch with you, what is the best way to do that?
Yeah, as I said, I'm not on social media much anymore, unless it's someone doing it for me. So just 415-805-8933. Drop me a call, shoot me a text. Just be respectful. Let me know what you're after, what you're trying to get into. Or, you know, hit me up through our website. I even have a booking calendar link on there. Again, if you're trying to sell me a service or something like that, give me a little heads up and I'll find you the best way. But if you just want to wrap, you want to potentially invest or talk about a sector that we're in, you know, just schedule time with me. I'd be happy to connect.
That's awesome. Matt, thanks so much for your time today. Certainly appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate podcast. If you can do me a favor and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen, if you can do that for us, that would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much, and hope to catch you on the next episode.